Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings, and I am the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, a show right here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we take a deep look at individual issues and stories that are going on in the wrestling world. Each episode is about a different topic, and we take a thorough and educated look at things ranging from current booking trends to breakdowns of individual performers and angles to investigations into different fan cultures across the industry. In addition, we keep a close eye on the wrestling media, and as a professional journalist, I bring a unique perspective to how current issues in wrestling are being covered and discussed through the wrestling media. We have a revolving series of guests from across wrestling punditry joining us on each episode, and we hope that you make the choice to give us a listen on wherever you get your podcast from.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Three, two, one. Welcome back to Those Days, a Michinoku Pro retrospective. Episode 14, The Formation of Kaientai Deluxe. Those Days is brought to you by Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network and the Open the Voice Gate podcast. You can find us on the Open the Voice Gate podcast feed as well as the Voices of Wrestling podcast feed. You can follow Open the Voice Gate on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site, and you click the red box as a sponsor of this podcast, and you set up a one-time or reoccurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, Case Lowe. And Case, this has been an episode that I've been really looking forward to getting to, like, when we started this project, and like when we were in like the early days of like, okay, we're essentially taking the 6-year block of Michinoku Pro and we're studying it from the start essentially to where it explodes. But one of the things that has always been kind of wrestling apocrypha and in a way has been Kaientai Deluxe. And this week and throughout the course of this episode, we finally have gotten to the point in Michinoku Pro's history that the Kaientai Deluxe that we all see, remember, and love have now finally formed in this episode of Those Days. And I've been really looking forward to get to this point.
You know, I'm very happy to be here, Mike, for the sheer notion of, while I encourage everybody to go back to the very beginning and listen to the work that we did for the Michinoku Pro shows in 1993 and 1994 and so on, because I think especially those early, early episodes where we talk about the formation of Michinoku Pro, we talk about a lot of things that really haven't been covered at large. And I really enjoyed the beginnings of this show, as I still do every episode. That's why we're doing it. But I really enjoyed the beginnings of this show talking about the history of Japanese independent wrestling and just the oddity that was Michinoku Pro in the beginning. I say all that because I imagine there's going to be a lot of people that are listening to Those Days for the first time ever, because there's the beginning of Michinoku Pro, and then there's the beginning of Michinoku Pro in 1996, which I think part of the reason we're doing this podcast, or at least part of the reason I want to do it, is to shed light on the history of the company that wasn't March through December 1996, because that is the lasting legacy of Michinoku Pro, as we're 30 years removed from this period. But I will say, as we dove into this footage and watched a lot of matches for this episode of Those Days, it feels really, really good to be in March of 1996.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the fact that now we are getting the tie-dye gear or Shiryu in the mask that we're used to, or the fact that now everyone, by the end of this episode, has essentially moved to the sides that they will be on during this this really hot stretch that, like, of course, when people think about Michinoku Pro and like this series, like, you think about those days in October of this year. But as we get into this episode, the story of Michinoku Pro's like peak is not just their show that they would have in Sumo Hall. Their peak, well, we're already kind of in the start of it at this point, and at least like through this time period that we'll be talking about, essentially we are going from March 16th, 1996 through June 23rd, 1996. It's essentially the extent of a comp tape that Michinoku Pro put out of the time called Sasuke and Me. But by this time, like, we are getting to see things that are, everything is kind of getting in line for the promotion as they do that build to Sumo Hall. But also at the same time, we're also getting to see the formation of everyone kind of getting in their right place for the J Crown tournament to happen this year as well. And I think it's just like this episode in particular is such a fascinating time, and especially thinking about the original Lucha-esque kind of big heel unit in Kaintai Deluxe. By the time that we are done tonight talking about this, the five players are all aligned as one, and Sekigun is in kind of in tatters, and we are 6 months out for, or at, by in this episode we're 4 months out from those days. These days, the show itself, and I'm really excited to see the build to this show and how it kind of kicks off a bit with this comp tape.
Few things to hit on off of that point. First of all, so like Mike said, we are primarily covering in this episode the comp tape called Sasuke and Me, which stretches from March 15th, technically, although we covered March 15th on the last episode. So March 16th through June 23rd. Astute listeners might already be wondering what that means for New Japan's Skydiving J Show, which happens on June 17th, 1996, and also the Inoki Peace Festival, which we plan on covering to some degree. Those will be covered in the next episode. We have tried to make this as chronological as possible. We are going to end this show on June 23rd, and then the next episode we will tackle June 1st, the Inoki Peace Show, and then a lot of the Skydiving J Show, which was a New Japan show, from June 17th. So we'll move back just a week because I think that is vital to the story of Michinoku Pro. We just don't have time to cover it in this episode. And quite honestly, as I look at the watch list for the next episode, that might become two episodes. That it is a daunting list as I look at it now. But
Are we about to do like our first side episode at this point? Like,
I don't know what we're gonna do. I haven't sent you the notes for this episode yet, but it is, yeah. even with all of these clip matches, it is a lot, because not to get too far ahead of ourselves, as we're literally in the beginning of episode 14, but episode 15 I have down right now, the history of the Inoki Peace Festival, Skydiving J, which features Shiryu versus Motegi, Hamada versus Takaiwa, Delphin versus Taka, Nanawa versus Ultimo, Dick Togo versus Jushin Thunder Liger, and Black Tiger versus Great Sasuke. We then have to talk about Sasuke's trip to Mexico for CMLL in July of 1996, and we have two full-length matches there. Sasuke Tiger Mask in Atlantis versus Negro Casas, Dr. Wagner Jr., and El Satanico, and then also a singles match between Sasuke and Casas. And then we go back and follow the journey of the World Championship title series, which then leads to the J Crown.
Yeah, the one thing that I want to add in is maybe that's when we talk about Yone Genjin and CMLL.
Because I got news for you, Mike. I did not watch Yone Genjin and CMLL this time around.
No. But like it's like this really interesting time in 1996 with all of this and like all the content. And like also like on my side, I need to get the Delphin book digitized, because I feel like we're at a point where we need that happening before we get to those days and the face turn is fully cemented. We need to get into like Delphin's backstory too. So
that's absolutely
something that we have probably, because just thinking on air production wise, does this mean episode 18 is Sumo Hall at this point?
Let me look at my notes here as I rapidly look for the Michinoku Pro folder on my Google Drive, 1996. So we are on episode 14. Episode 15 is next. If things actually went according to plan, then episode 16. Yeah, 16, okay. Two episodes from now, in which I have to talk to you about a guest that I want to bring on for that show, which is funny because I think that guest will hear this episode and not know that it's them yet. But yeah, that's the idea, is that in two episodes we're going to get to Sumo Hall, but that might end up being three episodes. It kind of depends on what that footage looks like and how we feel about that footage as we go about and watch it. To go back to a point you were making just a bit ago, you know, I think the simplest way to say this is we're now covering the period of Michinoku Pro, that when people hear Michinoku Pro, visually, this is what they think of. You're right. It's the gear. It's the names. It's the venues that everybody is familiar with. And in terms of watching Kaientai form here, Kaientai Deluxe form here, and then go forward, you know, one of the things that I've harped on throughout this series is that I want to figure out the evolution of the Lucharest trios match from what it looked like in Hamada's Universal to what it looked like in Michinoku Pro to then Toriumon and then Dragon Gate. And I'm trying to figure out why there's a disconnect between some people that, you know, listen to and enjoy this show that really enjoy Hamada's Universal and really enjoy Michinoku Pro. And maybe they even like the early days of Toriumon, but there's a disconnect somewhere in there as we get into Dragon Gate and beyond. And I'm trying to figure out what that is. I think one of the really interesting things about the footage in this episode is that when you start to see the really early days of Kaientai Deluxe, you see the foundation that the Lucharest Rudo unit was built on. And some of that was prevalent in Hamada's Universal, but in a way that I think was way more tied to the history of Mexican wrestling than the history of Japanese wrestling. And when you see those guys here, it's like, oh, okay, so I understand now how Kaientai Deluxe influenced Crazy Max and how Crazy Max influenced Blood Generation and how Blood Generation influenced everything beyond. It's really interesting diving back into some of this footage because now 1996, I've seen a lot of this stuff before. Although there's one match on this episode that we're going to cover that I had never seen before, that as we talk about Michinoku Pro Hidden Gems, it's on my list. I actually can't believe that it's not a bigger deal, the match that we'll discuss at some point in this episode. But it's really enjoyable now to, I think, have this fully fleshed out heel unit that now resembles so much of what you and I have loved about this style of wrestling over the last decade or so.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's the time now to kind of have like that kind of big picture thought. But I actually, I'm going to put a pin on this, and we're going to talk about this after the 623 match. I have a point that I want to get to about the evolution of the Rudo team and what we see across this episode. So I'm going to put a pin into that. But yeah, it, at this point, like when you're talking about like the Lucharest trios, like here is a thing for folks who listen to this and then go back and watch this. There's a lot of good trios and tag matches on this comp tape. And a lot of that is the fact that you are getting like the clear Michinoku Pro Sekigun side, as well as a fully developed trio of Kaientai Deluxe as they would become known before this episode basically starts, along with the renaming and the people that we would now know them by the name that essentially we know them now as today, as Men's Teho has taken over the name for Terry Boy. I mean, essentially it's just another translations of that, and Sato has abandoned that and is now in 1996 going as Dick Togo. So not only do we have the gear, but we have the names and everyone is in the right place. Like it's just like the Radiohead song.
I wasn't expecting, by the way, speaking of Radiohead, not that I talk about them in this episode, but I was finally a guest on Andrew Rich's Music of the Mat after years of not being invited onto that podcast, despite working in the music industry. Andrew Rich finally had me on. He did invite me to do an episode on Mania, which I was like, oh, like artists that have performed at WrestleMania. He's like, no, Mania, like mental illness. You know a lot about that. And so you can go to the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network or the Music of the Mat feed. And Andrew, Rich, and I broke down a bunch of songs about mental illness and paranoia and depression. He's like, you're the perfect guest for this. And I was. It was a very fun time. So that is my point on Radiohead. Excellent reference there. And I have nothing else to add as I am ready to jump into the timeline.
Yeah, let's get into it as we start the timeline for this episode. We jump into the Observer on March 11th, 1996 case as things are afoot in the Tokyo Dome.
Things are afoot in the Tokyo Dome, not for Michinoku Pro, but we have to start with, once again, their promotional partner in New Japan Pro Wrestling, as Dave writes on 311.96, as Mike said. New Japan Pro Wrestling held a press conference on March 4th to officially announce it would be holding its second Tokyo Dome card of the year on April 29th. The show will take place... It will take the place of the annual Fukuoka Dome show that traditionally takes place the first week of May. The apparent reason for the switch is over the past few years, New Japan has put out lineups for Fukuoka Dome, which is a much smaller city than Tokyo, far from any other major city in Japan that would easily sell the Tokyo Dome. But in Fukuoka, they were drawing in the 50,000 range. The announced four matches on this show, which are Nobuhiko Takada defending the IWGP Heavyweight title against Shinya Hashimoto, Tetsumi Fujinami versus Genichiro Tenryu in a battle of legends, the Road Warriors, who are huge draws in Japan in the 80s, and the Road Warriors versus Kensuke Sasaki and the Steiner Brothers and Scott Norton, and Jushin Thunder Liger defending his IWGP Junior Heavyweight title against the Great Sasuke. They announced there would be six more matches on the show. While not announced at the press conference, WCW will be sending Lex Luger in only his second career match in Japan, and Randy Savage will be making his New Japan debut on the show. Just from the four matches announced, it is believed that the show will be an easy sellout. At the press conference, New Japan also announced it would promote another Tokyo Dome show after this one before the end of 1996, making three for the year, and then in 1997, they would be promoting shows in new dome stadiums that will be opening up in the next year, both in Osaka and Nagoya. In addition, the belief is that Antonio Inoki will do another show with the North Korean government in the fall, where they set the all-time wrestling attendance record last year. And then I will continue to the next week's Observer, in which Dave notes that three more matches have officially been announced for that 429 Tokyo Dome show, including Randy Savage versus Hiroshi Tenzan, Lex Luger versus Masahiro Chono, and the Great Muta versus Jinsei Shinzaki. The final three matches on the card are expected to be announced sometime over the next week. And then Dave pontificates on the card while noting that Shinzaki would be making his return to Japan after leaving the WWF in this match. My big takeaway from this, and it will tie even more into when we talk about, you know, the business of that Tokyo Dome show, because we'll talk about Sasuke versus Liger and Shinzaki versus Muta when we get to it in the timeline. But I think part of the reason that 1996 is what it is in the context of Michinoku Pro is that it reminds me so much of mid-2010s New Japan during that era in which they were on fire, and it seemed like there was also a really healthy wrestling economy beneath them. That, and it wasn't, you know, oddly enough, the legacy brands of All Japan and Noah that were also really thriving during that time period. But you think about the business success that Dragon Gate had and the business success that DDT had, and even for a short while, the business success of a company like Big Japan. It goes to show when the top of the wrestling economy reaches a certain point of health, just what it can do for some of those bottom promotions or those independent promotions or those mid-major promotions. And I think 1996 in a lot of ways mirrors where we're at in 2016, which now feels completely absent in 2026.
Yeah, I think you raise a really valid point there, and you also have this all coinciding at a time that the Japanese Baseball League, NPB, essentially had like an era change of stadiums, essentially, that New Japan was able to really benefit from that, like in a level that, like, the Fukuoka Dome, like, yeah, Fukuoka is like the westernmost major city in Japan, and that they were able to get 50,000 in Fukuoka in their big dome stadium. But I mean, it is a real like vestige of like this like time period that I think that if we would continue at least the timeline of this, essentially like past the point that we're pointing to, and keep the eye on New Japan, like this right now is almost like the exact peak that they will be at before the Inoki crash and the MMA stuff in the 2000s, right? Like,
yeah,
the fact that they are looking into running every single dome stadium. So Osaka and Nagoya, those are both 45,000 seat stadiums right there. And doing that at a scale with like a backbone and a booking office that, like, in 1995, with Liger not necessarily being around as much, we saw some turmoil at least about who was getting used, and Michinoku Pro being a little bit out in the cold in 1995 with them. And with now, like, I also, you have like the fact that like Sasuke is back, really being the anchor of the junior heavyweight division, if not in, not only in the ring, but also in the booking office that like they're able to really kind of take advantage of about this. And you also look at this time that like these Tokyo Dome shows and time frame wise, and especially like when they would bring in like these kinds of outsiders for like spectacles, and really given the time, and especially with like the amount of aura, and we'll get into it in June with this, but or in April with this, like that of a spectacle that can like be put on by Shinzaki coming back from the United States from like the WWF extent. And we'll talk about like especially like the amount of kind of reverence that this is like propels him into being a similar national figure, if not at the level of Sasuke, but becoming one of in his own right as a promotional force, like built off of that, built off this dome show.
And speaking of business success, we have the 316 Michinoku Pro Show from Ota Ward in Tokyo to talk about, and we'll go to the business first, as on the March 25th, 1986 Observer, Dave notes that the other major small promotion show of the week was Michinoku Pro running a rare date in Tokyo, selling out the Ota Ward Gymnasium, which is 4,800 seats, not only to see the show, but to see the first meeting of Satoru Sayama and Dynamite Kid in 13 years, the two wrestlers who put the junior heavyweight division on the map in Japan and had a major impact on changing the face of wrestling worldwide, apparently hadn't met since Sayama quit New Japan in 1983. Both sat at ringside together to watch the main event as the latest Tiger Mask, a protege of Sayama, teamed with Shiryu and Great Sasuke to beat Taka Michinoku, Grand Nanawa, and Super Delphin in 26:50. After the match, Jinsei Shinzaki came to the ring and the fans began to chant Hakushi rather than Jinsei. He's supposed to wrestle in Japan under his Japanese wrestling name as opposed to his WWF name. However, all the pub in Japan about him being in the WWF all this time has made the fans think of him as Hakushi. Anyways, he did an interview in the ring saying he was going to beat Muta at the Tokyo Dome, and then Michinoku Pro announced that on October 10th, 1996, they would run a show at Tokyo Sumo Hall, which would be the biggest show in the history of the company.
Yeah, and we're on the road to Sumo Hall at this point. And just like the resilience, I have to say, over essentially like the last 2 years in Ota War, like dating back to when they had the 88th Temple with Shinzaki and Sasuke, the fact that they've been able to continue this and make this into their kind of foothold. And thinking about the stretch that they were on, I mean, they were doing about 2,000 Osaka the day before this. And it's really kind of remarkable in its way of how much, and then 5,000 in Sapporo to start the year. So their 1996 business success, you already have two or three shows that are major houses across Japan, not just in the Tohoku market. And the fact that now they're staring down October 10th, 1996 and Sumo Hall at this point as like the next big thing. But, and all they have at this point is pure momentum if you're just looking at the box office for them.
Very much so. And so that takes us to the 316 show from Ota Ward. I would say of the things that we haven't gotten to see so far in this timeline, timeline of Michinoku Pro footage. I mean, there's some early 1993 stuff when there's a heavier emphasis on luchadors that I would have really liked to have seen made tape. I mean, Hamada's working so much in 1993, and we really don't see any of it, which I think is a shame. There's been a few things, you know, we talked in the last episode about, you know, some of the Kato Kung Lee matches or some of the Kendo matches that happen but don't make tape, and what a bummer it is not to see those. I would really like to see Michinoku Pro's Someday I'll Be Saturday Night in full, because we get a clipped version of Dick Togo and Mince Teo versus Pantera and Grand Hamada, and then we get the main event in full, all 2650 of that. We do not get any of Funaki versus Hoshikawa. We do not get any of Aero Flash versus Masato Yakushiji. Luckily, we also do not get any of the 16 minutes of Wellington Wilkins Jr. versus Yone Genjin, but I would really like to see what this show looks like in full.
You know that's going to have 3 minutes of dicking around in the push cart, too, of that 16 minutes.
Yeah, no, that is a match that I really do not have any interest in. But the other stuff looks incredible.
Yeah, so let's talk about the clipped Kaientai Deluxe versus Hamada and El Pantera match.
Let's talk about how it looked like the greatest wrestling match of all time, just from the way that this match was clipped up.
Yeah, and like the amount of confidence, like about like missing footage, we don't have the rebrand footage of Tejo and Togo and Shiryu sticking with like the heel mask. Like that's one thing that would be really kind of cool to have, given what else we have on this tape to get that as well. But this is just good, like just classic Lucha Rest tag stuff. Mm-hmm. Hamada headbutt is just excellent in this. Tejo has really, with the rebrand, has found himself as like a really big prick in it, and that's great. And the thing that at least you get to see starting this tape, and the big, I think, the takeaway of this is when we've seen the trio of Kai and Tai in 1994 and into 1995, there was a level of aggression that they would exude towards Delphin Core and Super Delphin, but they would not exude it to Seki Gunn or virtually everyone else on the roster. They would wrestle as pure technicos outside of that. That's no longer the case. The edge of Kai and Tai Deluxe now has spread to the remainder of the roster as we see through this match. And now really there are three units in Michinoku Pro, and this match kind of gets in your head in that now Kai and Tai Deluxe are the heels in the promotion. And it is a kind of a wonderful kind of display, at least from Togo and Tao in that.
Absolutely. I mean, you got to remember, we left off the last episode, which they ran, you know, that show in Osaka, and that ends with Shiryu being propositioned by Dick Togo on one side and Great Sasuke and Tiger Mask on the other. And Shiryu makes a very deliberate choice to align himself with Dick Togo going forward. And yeah, you're right. You see a clear, definitive presentation change in the way that Kai and Tai, now Kai and Tai Deluxe, operates. I will say, when we began this series compared to where we're at now, I never expected to say the words, "I'm going to really miss Terry Boy." And for as good as Miz Tao is in a lot of the footage that we see in this episode specifically, I am going to really miss Terry Boy and that approach that he brought to the ring.
Yeah, like, I know that this is a progression and that this day was going to come, but my one of my big takeaways from the series, and it at least at the time of recording, we are in the 5-year plan of Greatest Wrestler Ever, is just like my reassessment of like the foundations of Lucha Rest. And Terry Boy Mins Tejo has really entered the conversation to me to an extent that I think I'm gonna have to go like hunt down like the Big Japan stuff and like the men's club stuff, because I really think that he has like this argument of being like 100th greatest wrestler of all time. And a lot of that is because of how excellent he was in this essential 4-year stretch before becoming Mins Tejo. So this change had to happen, and it also everything being in the right place, like, yes, this day was to come here. But man, I really want to go and like and leave the memories alone with like all the Terry Boy stuff, but I feel a little bit of missing and longing now that we no longer have Terry Boy and Sato around.
You know, I think he suffers from a thing that, you know, when you look at some of this footage through the Greatest Wrestler Ever lens, that for whatever reason, I think plagued 90s juniors far more than it did the next generation of guys that maybe debuted in the 2000s and then, you know, kept going through the 2010s in a sort of relevant way. But you think about Sasuke and you think about Ultimo and you think about Mins Tejo, and even, you know, Shiryu, just because of some of the places that he worked, and even Taka, when that calendar flips over to the 2000s, they don't have the catalog. Now, Taka has a little bit of it in 2002. I mean, he's really excellent whenever he popped up in 01. And although that period of All Japan is a pretty big blind spot for me, I feel like the pimped Taka stuff over the years is stuff that I've gone out of my way to watch because I like him so much. But the only guy that I think really survives strong into the 2000s and then has a complete revival in the 2010s before he retired was Dick Togo. And I just think it's a bummer that a lot of his contemporaries, for whatever reason, it's like when that Michinoku Pro Osaka Pro split happens, that a lot of these guys, I mean, Yakushiji's another one where, you know, you and I think the world of him over this period sort of starting in 96 through that Osaka Pro split. And then, you know, we get to the 21st century and these guys, just for whatever reason, whether it was their bodies not holding up in the case of Sasuke and Ultimo, or for whatever reason, they just don't have the work to back up some of those claims, because at their peak, these are some of, you know, the finer wrestlers that we've seen. But I'm a guy that values longevity and volume, and they really struggle in that regard.
Yeah, and especially like when you like look at Tejo in comparison to the other ones, like he does not have like the tail outside of Kai and Tai, even that like Kazayashi would have. Really, when you like think about it, he's someone that essentially by the end of like the 2000s, he's out of like any major promotion of note. And I mean, he's still kicking around, but it's like Secret Base and places like that, like micro indies at this point. So and I feel like that there's a big difference, at least in how like the your output when you get to those kinds of points, you know.
Absolutely.
Like he's like Tejo has had essentially 60 matches since COVID, and the biggest promotion he has appeared in, he has made one appearance in All Japan, a couple in Michinoku Pro, and outside of that it is essentially just Secret Base, TTT, and occasionally in 2AW. He's main essentially event. Out of the industry. Yeah.
I mean, you know, and we're talking almost 30 years after this now, so I wouldn't expect him to be going at a high level. But I do think it's odd that, you know, once he makes that shift to Big Japan, it's just a complete loss of relevancy in any way. And I don't know of any. I mean, I'm sure. Well, that's not true. He's got a match in 2008. Let me see if I can find this really quick, because I feel like there's one really, really highly thought of Tejo match from that Big Japan run, and I can picture that. Yeah, it's okay. So now this match, I don't know if you've seen this, Mike. This match is going to sound really bad on paper. May 23rd, 2008, Big Japan. This is in Korakuen, and it's okay. It's a Big Japan tag team title match. It's Men's Tejo and Shinobu versus Kengo Mishima and Madoka. I understand,
very 2008 indies and Big Japan match.
And I understand why that might not sound awesome. Let me assure you, that match is awesome, and everybody should go track it down if you've never seen it before.
Oh, Shinobu at that time, I mean, like, he's coming off of his Tozawa Juku assistant run. Like, Shinobu was a serious indie junior heavyweight, I feel like, in that 2008 time period. Yeah.
Basically that 2008 time period, and then that one match he has with Daisuke Sekimoto in 2014, which was the first Sekimoto match that I watched. I remember subscribing to The Observer for the first time, logging onto the board, and seeing Alan Forel rave about this Daisuke Sekimoto guy in this match versus Shinobu, and I was like, well, I might as well give this a shot. And boy, did that open my eyes to an entirely new world of wrestling. So shout out to Shinobu. As we get to the main event of this Ota Ward show, we get this match in full: Shiryu, Sasuke, and Tiger Mask versus Nanawa, Delphin, and Taka Michinoku. This is essential Michinoku Pro viewing. This is going to be on any Best of Michinoku Pro DVD or playlist.
Easily.
Or torrent or whatever. Mike, I'll throw it to you first. I have some thoughts on this match, but I want to know what you think of it.
Oh, this is my third Hell Yeah match. Like, this is the first Hell Yeah trios. Also, like, my previous two were singles matches, but this is as bedrock of a Lucha-esque trios match as one can get. And you add in the fact that Shiryu is the reluctant to team with Sasuke and Tiger Mask for, like, he stands in opposite corners. He's not really ever on the same page with them throughout it. And you have that, like, through line. And then you have what I think is probably a top three Michinoku Pro all-time pairing at this point of Taka and Tiger Mask 4 as the bedrock of this match. Just always kind of going back to each other. And you also, in a way, this is kind of the last great Dolphin Core match, I would say, it just because of how everything would fall apart here. And essentially, after this point, there is Dolphin Core essentially falling apart over the next few months. And at least for this night, you have this incredible performance, and also for someone that we've been kind of up and down on, I think that Delphin was an active positive in this match and was as plugged in as anyone in this. I was 4.5 stars on it. It was utterly amazing. And I every time from now on that I know that Taka Michinoku and Tiger Mask 4 are on opposite sides of each other. I am geared up. And again, just to go back on stuff that we said in previous episodes, Tiger Mask 4 is still a rookie at this point, and he main events a near 5,000 attendance show, and he is the overwhelming star of this match, and he feels completely comfortable in that kind of role. And that is something, as he is retiring in a few months, I feel like I want to highlight and double underline is how much of a super rookie this guy was, because he owned the moment and won, and ended up winning the match with a Tiger Suplex hold on Taka Michinoku in almost 27 minutes.
I think the thing that stood out to me in this match the most, by the way, Rookie of the Year Award, 1996 Wrestling Observer Newsletter, Tiger Mask 4 does not place. Your winner that year is the Giant, followed by Yuki Kondo, followed by Rocky Maivia. I guess I have to look now just because I'm so curious to see if people voted for him in 95, and this was like a Shingo Takagi situation where he placed for Rookie of the Year in two different years, but I get the feeling that people just completely whiffed on Tiger Mask as a viable candidate. I have to look at this really quick now that I'm thinking about it.
I mean, it's a testament of 1996 in pro wrestling that Paul White was the Wrestling Observer Rookie of the Year and The Rock was third, and no Tiger Mask 4, but God, this feels like one of the most overlooked rookie years in wrestling history.
95 is Paraguayo Jr., which is fair. KGB, Chris Canyon, your top three. And then I guess I have to go down to 97 now just to see if for some reason people were really late on this guy. But I don't think that's going to be the case whatsoever, as I just try to find some way to justify any sort of placement for Tiger Mask 4 in my head for these Rookie of the Year voting. And no, he is not in this one either. 1997 is Mr. Aguaya, Chris Chetty, Don Fry, Kazuyuki Fujita, and Ogawa, your top. That's a fascinating top five. Ernest Miller finishes ninth. So no justice for Tiger Mask 4 there. My big takeaway coming from this match is, again, I'm very interested in studying the evolution of these trios matches and how they change and morph over the years. And so when you look at the Pimp Trios matches, and I have my Michinoku Pro match guide spreadsheet now in the Open the Voice Gate channel on our Discord. I finally dropped that link this past week, so you can look at all of this. But, you know, 3/16/93, there's a match between Mongolian Yuga, Ricky Santana, and Super Delphin versus Black Man El Sagrada and Kendo. And that is on the first Michinoku Pro show. That is spiritually a Hamada's Universal match, in the same way that, you know, 4/29/94, Kendo Sato and Shiryu versus Grand Anoa Rams and Super Delphin. It's still a style of wrestling that is based far more in, I think, old school Lucha Libre, classic Lucha Libre, than in what we would now recognize as like a modernized Japanese wrestling. Even the touring match from the UK tour, February 6, 1996, you know, Sasuke, Hanzo Nakajima, and Tiger Mask versus Sato, Shiryu Boy, and Sato, Shiryu, and Terry Boy. It's Michinoku Pro fundamentals, but there isn't really the thing that makes me go like, wow, that's a Michinoku Pro match, if there ever was one. You know, my match of the series to this point, still the best thing that I think that I've seen, was that six-man tag at the Cork and Hall show in February of 1994, which was Sato, Shiryu, and Sasuke versus Nanawa Shinzaki and Delphin. And that is sort of the peak of the Hamada's Universal style, and far, far from, I think, the in-ring that we saw in this match. The thing that I think really is on display here is, as this match hit the finishing stretch, this match is 26 minutes and it starts slow. Now, it starts deliberately slow, I think far more deliberately slow than what we would see from those trios matches, 93, 94, 95, and then, you know, really throwing out that touring tag in the UK, because I don't really think that counts for something like this. But it's a much more deliberate pace. They're working a bigger room. They're kind of doing that thing of, you know, and we see it with Sasuke and Liger to some degree, you know, later on in this episode, but, you know, that juniors match in the big room, in the big arena or the dome, and how sometimes the air gets sucked out of those matches because they try to work an epic when that's not really what their strength is. And this match, you know, it takes a while to get going in a way where it almost falls into that danger. I think the thing that is noticeable here is the finishing stretch of this match, that last 10 minutes, I think is far more rooted in what a company like AAA was doing at the time, which was light heavyweights. They fly through the air, but they're very inspired by All Japan Pro Wrestling finishing stretches, and they take that and make it their own, rather than however you want to define the characteristics of a Hamada's Universal Trios match. I don't feel like those matches sometimes give way to the amount of heat that these Michinoku Pro style trios matches could generate, and I think it's very noticeable here. There's a lot more head drops. There's a lot harder striking. And that's something that when you go back and read the 95 Observers, you know, Dave via Conan is talking about how all of those AAA guys were watching the All Japan tapes and they wanted to integrate those style of big moves into their matches. And I would imagine that that then trickled into Michinoku Pro, where it's less, you know, in that finishing stretch, it's less gorgeous arm drags and flash pins and more, I'm dropping you on your head, whether you like it or not. And this, to me, is now a definitive shift from where this company was at in 93, 94, 95.
Yeah, and I would say that part of that shift, you also have to look at now, and this was a conversation I was going to, this was going to be the post last match conversation, but I feel like we could have this one here and it's more appropriate here. There's a definite difference in the heel work that you saw from Delphin Corps, and basically up until this point being the heel unit of kind of note here, and essentially a level of seriousness with that group that was not there, that Kai and Tai Deluxe is an incredibly serious heel unit that is very violent about their way of their conducting their business. Whereas, like, in a lot of ways, I feel like Delphin Corps feels like a dangerous alliance, like stable, or more so the kind of territorial heel stable where you have the manager, which would have been Mr. Toyota for the time period, and the lead star, but then a bunch of goons below them, essentially. And that's kind of like what the stud stable or whatever would have you for a certain time period. Kai and Tai works like a level of killers, like trying to dismantle everyone. And also at the same time, you have the evolution of Taka Michinoku on the other side being like, oh yeah, no, y'all want to do your snap power slams and all this out of everywhere. That's okay. I'm going to do like a forearm that I'm going to try to take your head off every single time. So you have like the right kind of partner to go with them in these matches, at least to start. And I think that also like marks the stylistic change as well.
Just from a in-ring standpoint, some of the things that really jumped out to me in this match, Shiryu does a number of insane dives. He does the Santo dive with, you know, that Tope Suicida, but near the post. You know, he does it in the corner of the ring. He does that at one point. That looks completely insane. Taka does a big 180 moonsault to the floor that looks absolutely nuts. There's a moment in the match where Delphin is applying the Delphin clutch. Pinfall attempt. Sasuke comes out of nowhere with a springboard dropkick and just knocks him into oblivion. The way they shot that was absolutely perfect. You don't see Sasuke at all until he is kicking Delphin in the head in midair. You get another great huge Tope Suicida from Shiryu on Delphin towards the end of the match. A big no-touch Tope from Sasuke to Nanoa. And then you get the Tiger Suplex on Taka Michinoku for the finish. 4.25 stars from me. Absolutely essential viewing.
And the neat thing, at least with this comp tape as we go on here, is that it's really treated like this is the documentary of Michinoku Pro from March into June of 1996. We get into this segment that's called Michi Pro News, where it has the backstage segments of Kai and Tai and Sekigun arguing backstage, and then other clips from Oda Ward with Dynamite Kid and Sayama reuniting, and the lights out Shinzaki entrance from that was mentioned in the Observer. So it's kind of like a nice thing. But you also have aspects of before the next show, the bus gets caught in a giant ditch and Wellington Wilkins tries to push it out here. So there's a lot of everything on this comp tape.
Yeah, I obviously don't have the translations for it, but I like the backstage segment as I continue to rave about just the way that these Michinoku Pro backstage segments are shot and how real they feel, and how I just really like the way they're presented. The backstage promo with Sasuke in Togo and Shiryu, the way that I interpreted that was Sasuke sort of pleading with Shiryu to not side with Dick Togo. And once again, Shiryu goes with Togo, and that seems to be a done issue now. It seems like they're officially aligned. You get the footage of Sayama and Dynamite Kid in the ring together. I would love to know. Yeah, I looked for translation to see if there was anything there, but there wasn't. And then we get Jinsei Shinzaki returning to the Michinoku Pro ring for the first time since the end of 1994. Mike, you talked a little bit earlier about digitizing Super Delphin's book. I think we briefly covered this on the last episode, but just quickly, if you want to discuss sort of what you've been doing with some of these books and then the context behind this Jinsei Shinzaki book before I read a passage from it.
So I have discovered in like my overall like kind of Japanese wrestling merch journey case, like, you know, like I've got a wall of Shoe Pros and Weekly Gongs in my office. I collect things that and a lot of it is just like I like to see them and they make me happy. But after Sasuke Soars and we were able to go through that book and how interesting it was, I kind of looked into this a wrestler autobiography kind of industry. And there's like these styles of books are called tankobons, which are essentially 200 page books, like the size of like a trade paperback book, that there were a bunch of them that were released during this time period. And like Sasuke Scores was one of them. And I have like over at least the year of this, I now have a like six or seven of them. And I, as a media preservationist, at least by training, I wanted to kind of, other than like getting these, is kind of like looking and see what's kind of interesting with it. So the first one that I took my book scanner out and digitized and went through stuff that if some of this technology was around when I was like in like my peak archiving days, the amount of stuff I could have got up to would have been astounding. But the first book I picked up and kind of scanned was Jinsei Shinzaki's book. I did not really get like a pure title out of it. It's essentially he phrases it like a pilgrim's diary. And essentially this is a book that they put out essentially it comes out in mid-96 between this match with Muto and his return and the later match of Hayabusa. But the interesting thing about this book is essentially a diary of his life in WWF in that like 15-month time period and the lead up to the Great Muta match. And one of the things that I think we've discovered is that it's a lot more kayfabed than the Sayama, not the Sayama book, the Sasuke book. But it is very kind of interesting in a certain kind of way, at least as like a testament of like the time period, and at least getting more in depth into like Shinzaki as a character and as a wrestler, kind of going through this time period. But the big crescendo point in his book is his return back to Japan after his WWF stint and this Tokyo Dome show with the Great Muta. And it's an interesting book, Kiss. I sent you the PDFs a while back, and I think like the big like kind of takeaway, at least from the book itself, is essentially like the adjustment from the Michinoku Pro kind of wrestling lifestyle to the lifestyle that he was thrust into the new generation WWF of 1994. Like that to me is like the most interesting kind of thing, is like his takeaways of his life as a WWF wrestler in a way.
Yeah. You know, I'm still trying to figure out, while I have a desire to keep this podcast as chronological as we can, there's some Shinzaki stuff in there that is interesting to me that I haven't quite figured out what I want to do with. I think one of the points that he makes that I found to be interesting is, you know, he talks about how he's actually wrestling a more hectic schedule in the WWF than he was in Michinoku Pro, because you have to get to the building early and cut promos and shoot vignettes, and sometimes you're wrestling twice a day. But he also makes the point, he goes, you know, the difference is, you know, I might wrestle a 6-day stretch in Michinoku Pro where I wrestle six really hard matches in a row, but I might wrestle an 8-day stretch to WWF and all of my matches are 2 minutes long. And it's just a weird thing that he discusses there. I think there's interesting insight in that book. So I'm trying to find places to revisit this as we go along, but I do have this passage here.
We'll try to like do this. Like, what I wanted to get the Delphin book done at least by the these days shows, especially like as we like move our way at later on in the show series, to at least get his perspective on the things that lead up to Ahsoka split. But there'll be things that in these books that we'll be able to kind of reassess things. And maybe it is that if we want to kind of do like a spinoff episode talking about some of the things at times, we might look into that direction, just because of these books are really kind of interesting in certain kinds of ways.
So Shinzaki writes, on March 16th, 1996, I found myself being drawn almost against my will to Otowar Gymnasium. I deliberately say I, because while I was certainly Shinzaki Jinsei, the one standing there that day was unmistakably Hakushi, the man born in the WWF and raised in New York. As you can tell from the diary in Chapter 3 breaks off midway, I had temporarily stepped away from the WWF schedule and returned to Japan. I received word that my first temple stop on the road home, in quotations, the match with Great Muta, was finally likely to be officially set for April. In order to further discipline both my mind and body and to focus all my nerves on that one match, I had withdrawn to my hometown of Tokushima and kept myself hidden away. At first, I had intended not to show myself at all until my entrance at the Tokyo Dome. After all, it would be my first fight in Japan since transforming into Hakushi, and I thought it would be best to hide in that sense of mystery at that point. At that point, I still hadn't completely sorted things out within myself, whether I would fight more Shinzaki Jinsei or build the match around the Hakushi style. Either way, I believe that appearing in an idolized form was best. And yet, as if something were pulling me in, I ended up going to Ota Ward Gymnasium. That day, Michidoku Pro was running its Tokyo anniversary show at Ota Ward. Since my opponent for the first temple stop wasn't anyone inside Michidoku Pro, it would have been easy enough to ignore the event entirely. But as the day drew closer, one phrase had begun to echo in my mind over and over, quote, even when far away, my heart remains in Michinoku, end quote. That was something I myself had said when I left for the WWF pilgrimage. If that was true, then wouldn't it be strange for my return match to happen in a New Japan ring? Was that really right? Wasn't it the fact that my heart was now fixed only on the Muta match? Was this really okay? In the end, I felt that before anything else, appearing in front of the Michidoku Pro fans was the very least responsibility I owed as the man who had spoken those words. That is why I went to Ota Ward Gymnasium as the private individual Shinzaki Jinsei and as the public figure Hakushi. I don't know how many people understood my intentions, but on that day, as promised, Shinzaki Jinsei's heart descended upon Michidoku Pro. In the first place Hakushi ever appeared in Japan was, after all, a Michidoku Pro venue. At Ota Ward Gymnasium, the place where I defeated Sasuke at the very first temple stop, Hakushi appeared like a ghost. At the time, I never imagined that this would turn out to be the first and last time that Hakushi would appear in Michinoku Pro.
Yeah, so that is very much kind of the tone of the book. It, as I said earlier, it's a lot more kind of kayfabe and more into the aspect of him being the pilgrim character, and the fact that he treats at least like his entire Michinoku Pro as the one temple loop of the traditional 88 temples of Shizuoka, and that he was treating each match as like a temple here, and it's a lot of that kind of ethos with this, and a lot of kind of differentiating the Jinsei Shinzaki character from the Hakushi character, and that still is something that they still kind of play deeply upon in the Tokyo Dome match. He is billed as Shinzaki Hakushi's Jinsei throughout it.
Indeed. So as we continue along with the timeline here, we put Ota Ward in the rear view, and we get to the 323 show in Fukushima, which was announced as a sellout of 720 people. We get Shiryu versus Great Sasuke in the first match of two matches we get on this show. Mike, this is a very prolonged beatdown of Great Sasuke for the most part. Actually, Sasuke starts off the match by putting Shiryu in a very long half crab, and then the momentum flips and we get Shiryu beating up on Sasuke quite a bit.
Yeah, and like the real kind of thing about this is that during the kind of beatdown at the start of the match, Mince Teo and Dick Togo come out and sit and basically loom over this, basically going like, Shiryu, kind of get your act together. And then at that point, he really dismantles his knee and then gets Sasuke in a half crab of his own, getting the submission there after the after a run-in by Togo. Fukushima is absolutely apoplectic at this. Like, and this is the first match on the show, and they already have them kind of frothing over the Despicable Kaintai Deluxe.
It's a placeholder match for the main event, which is Mins Tejo and Dick Togo beating Super Delphin and Grand Nanawa. And Mike, you made the point earlier that I thought was really astute of just the difference in presentation and the evolution of Delphin and Nanawa and the way they're presented compared to the really harsh, really brutal Kai and Tai Deluxe at this point. And we get a match in which Togo and Tejo just completely out-heel and dominate Delphin and Nanawa in a way that in 1994 would have been completely unimaginable.
Yeah, and if we were able to take all the injury time off that was suffered by the Kai and Tai guys, this feels like the perfect kind of match right after Togo wins the UWA belt, right? Like, this is the him and Tejo just being absolute jackals, and Togo obliterates Delphin in the first few minutes, and then it becomes a two-on-one attack on Nanawa. They absolutely destroy his mask. You get the Dragon Kid at Final Gate 2020 thing, where his mask is so destroyed that he throws it down. The Dream Chasers and Yone Genjin, the last remaining kind of guys who are on Delphin Corps side, are kind of out there trying to help as much as they can, but it's just not enough, and it's not going to be enough for them, as Tejo and Togo just obliterate Nanawa as he's trying to fight this all off. And it's you really see the maturation of Nanawa, like, as an adult, kind of being like, all right, I'm throwing down my shtick and I'm fighting back as much as I can here. And but it's not enough. And Kai and Tai Deluxe wins after the senton, a chair shot, body slam. And that leads this crowd in a real kind of state. Afterwards, Gene Tracers and Yoni Genjin try to save Nanawa. He's already completely, like, beaten down, unmasked, and Sasuke eventually hits the ring as Kai and Tai Deluxe was able to dispatch them. They're able to get a level of civility in the ring when Sasuke finally gets out there, and they end this show in Fukushima with Delphin and Sasuke uniting, and at least at this point deciding that they're going to be a united force to take down Kai and Tai Deluxe after what all has happened just in the last 2 weeks in Michinoku Pro.
So from a consequences standpoint, I mean, we're talking about one of the more impactful shows in the history of Michinoku Pro, and we're now on this run again. I know we started this episode with 316, but when you go back to the Osaka show from 8 days before this, you see just this sort of avalanche effect happen where one angle bleeds into the other. And so, you know, that Sasuke versus Shiryu match that began this show is not a great match by any means, but it's also not supposed to be. It's deliberately slow and deliberately really brutal. And then you get into this tag match where, you know, Dick Togo is choking Super Delphin with a chair 2 minutes into this match. And like you pointed out, you know, Nanawa is maskless by the end of this. He's maskless going for a cross body to the floor on Dick Togo. And then you get some heel interference and you end up with a Kai and Tai DX win. The post-match angle here is one of the better angles that we've seen. And there's nothing overly complex about it. The beauty is in the simplicity of at this point in time. And this has been an interesting thing for me to go about, because I don't really think I've ever seen the formation of Kai and Tai in this way, where Funaki and Taka Michinoku are not in the unit yet. And they start being actively courted by Kai and Tai Deluxe as we go through this footage. But, you know, Funaki and Taka make the save. They're the ones that try to run off Tejo and Shiryu and Togo. It's not enough when those guys do it. And so out comes Sasuke. And at that point, the Fukushima crowd goes absolutely ballistic, because they immediately pick up on, okay, Delphin's in the ring, but Taka gets dumped, Funaki gets dumped, Yone Genjin, no help whatsoever. And so Sasuke, who has this brutalized knee, and this will come up as we go throughout this episode, is we're now in one of those really great stretches where Sasuke has a permanent injury that ties into every match. Sasuke is on this bad knee, clearing house, and then you get what is essentially the Michinoku Pro Mega Powers handshake at the end of this, with Sasuke and Delphin putting 3 years, really 4 years if you want to go back to 1992 in Universal, 4 years of hatred behind them, and all of a sudden they are now tasked with fighting off Kai and Ty DX. And I just think this angle is absolutely superb.
And like you do kind of have like these like moments of that. You do kind of see a little bit of Mitch and of Taka and Funaki kind of side eyeing it a little bit. Nanawa has already kind of is out of this, but like the idea that Delphin like unilaterally is deciding like, yes, I'm going to team up with you now because I'm super Delphin and these are the things that I do, that in his way, he's always right about things. So this was the right time for him to bury that hatchet at this point. What, it wasn't his mask getting torn off at in this match, at least.
Really, really well done. I really enjoyed that angle. So that is on 323. We do get brief footage the next day of a title match as we get the WWF light heavyweight title that Aero Flash, who is a wrestler who was, you know, from what I can garner, a mid-card wrestler in the dying days of the UWA, who somehow ended up in Michinoku Pro for quite a few matches in 1996. We get Sasuke versus Aero Flash, and we get a few minutes here of Sasuke defeating him and winning the WWF light heavyweight title. Any thoughts on that match, Mike, before we move to April?
No, we really did not get that much of that match that we clipped, other than the fact that, like, again, we're getting people into, like, close to their J Crown kind of positions at this point. And that's kind of the noble thing there, at least.
Dave would follow up on the April 2nd, 1986 Observer, saying that Great Sasuke, who missed most of the past week with an injury, which Dave then writes, must have been pretty serious for him to miss any matches, captured the WWF light heavyweight title, which had formerly been a title for the UWA promotion in Mexico, beating Aero Flash, like we just talked about. And Dave notes that this gives Sasuke both the WWF and British titles in the lighter heavyweight divisions leading up to his match, with Jushin Thunder Liger at the Tokyo Dome. Our footage then jumps from that Sasuke versus Aero Flash match on March 24th. We move a month forward to April 23rd, and we get Sasuke versus Collins for just a second. We get the note from the 415 Observer that the next Michinoku Pro Tour will have Danny Collins from England and Kato Kung Lee from EMLL. Unfortunately, we do not get any Kato Kung Lee on this comp tape, and we miss out on a Kato Kung Lee versus Super Delphin CMLL welterweight title match on April 27th. Mike, we really only get a second of Collins versus Sasuke?
Yeah, and all we kind of get is a bit of punch and kick, essentially, out of it. My only note I have is that Danny Boy Collins at this point kind of moves around like a muscle action figure. Like, do you remember the show Muscle? Like, is this a reference that you can get?
Well, no, unfamiliar.
Muscle, the Kaneko Men shows, where like this anime thing, the Muscle Buster comes from this show. It's a move that was like a wrestling show, but like these figures were basically these just giant rubber blocks that weren't very movable, not very poseable, and they're kind of like hulking in their no neck, and they just have like just kind of like dopey kind of bow arms like this. And that was kind of my takeaway, was that Danny Collins had a wrestler figure body. That's the only thing I have for this. Sasuke wins on a count out. Like, what is there to this?
So this is what I find odd, because I also thought Sasuke won on a count out, but Dave notes in the Observer and Cage Match has this as Danny Collins winning this match in 223. And I don't understand how Collins could have won based on the footage that we have, but Sasuke,
I think they're confusing that with a later match that gets Collins, that happens in May, because Collins loses the British Junior Heavyweight title that Sasuke held. Oh, so like there
right.
was
I'm, a, I'm looking at the wrong show. That would do it. You're right. Sasuke wins via count out in 1433. I apologize. I am wrong on that one.
No worries. No worries, bud.
God, the top three matches on that show. So it's Sasuke versus Collins in the main event. Before that, Togo Teo and Shiryu versus Nanawa, Hoshikawa, and Delphin. And before that, Hamada and Tiger Mask versus Kato Kung Lee and Ninja de Fuego, who's Kendo. And then Hoshikawa versus Yakushushi. Why did we not get this show on this comp tape? Good Lord.
A lot of Hoshikawa we could be seeing right now.
A lot of Kendo we could be seeing.
You know who I need to check to make sure? I as I'm seeing someone in these in the results pop up that it might be this person here. At this point, Case, you know who has made his debut on this show also? This actual show in Fukushima on April 23rd, 1996. I can't believe that's this case. Case, this show has the debut of one Yoshihito Sugimoto, who you know as Gamma.
This is on which
April
show?
April 23rd, 1996.
Okay, so
Gamma debuts on this show also.
So do you know? Okay, so let me read this full card because this is an interesting discovery, and this
because he's Sugimoto at this point.
Yes. So this is April 23rd, 1996. This is the first stop on this tour, and I'm gonna read this card and then I'll make the point. So it's Wellington Wilkins Jr. versus Makoto Saito. It's then Wellington Wilkins Jr. versus Yoshito Sugimoto, and then Hoshikawa versus Yakushuji, Hamada and Tiger Mask versus Kato Kung Lee and Ninja de Fuego, Togo Teo Shiryu versus Nanawa Hoshikawa and Delphin, and Sasuke versus Danny Collins. This is, as you said, Mike, the debut of Gamma. Do you recognize the name of the opening match of Makoto Saito?
You fucking better know that I recognize that name. That's Kness.
That is also the debut of Kness.
What a show we have stumbled upon here.
Wow. I can't believe we don't have any footage of that whatsoever. That sucks.
And this one makes sense because I would look around at the crowd. I'm like, you're not just seeing Yakushiji out there doing young boy duties anymore at this point. Like, there's other folks out there. And lo and behold, those other folks are people that we are very, very well aware of. Geez, I wish we really have this whole show on tape. Ninoue Owate is this show. Yeah. Wow.
Absolutely incredible. So that, on the opposite end of the spectrum, not a house show in Owate in front of 200 people, but rather the Tokyo Dome on April 29th. We'll briefly move away from Michinoku Pro just to talk about these two matches, as I do feel they are super consequential to the Michinoku Pro promotion. Battle Formation Absolutely. 96, Sasuke versus Liger, Shinzaki versus Muta. Let's start with Sasuke versus Liger, Mike. We've seen this match before, but never at the Tokyo Dome. Your thoughts on this?
This was a crowd that was here to see Sasuke go off to the races. And it was kind of interesting, like the fact of how much of a babyface Sasuke was in this versus Liger, and how much more like giving this is, like when you compare this to J Cup 94, of course, and like the mentality of like Jushin Thunder Liger was a prick to everyone in 1994 who wasn't a New Japan pro wrestler. So now there's like this level of kind of like respect of this, and it becomes a Sasuke Nien Shin selling match. It's not as good as the J Cup match, and maybe not the Sapporo match. But I thought that the closing stretch though was really kind of tremendous, and the way that like this is Sasuke wins by dipping into his moveset and a move that he has that Liger would not have seen Sasuke do before. He wins the Tiger Suplex hold that he's picked up because of all the work of Tiger Mask and Tiger Mask 4. And I thought that that was kind of a fun aspect to it. But I thought it lived up to like the series that we've seen between the two guys. But I wouldn't put this on the same level as some of the stuff from 1994. But it's still worth going out of your way for, though.
I found the match to be far more interesting when Liger was working on top rather than when Sasuke was dominating offensively. I thought both guys' really big moves looked great. It had been a while. I mean, I guess since Liger, since we did the J Cup stuff in 94, was the last time that I watched Liger. And before that, it had certainly been a while. So I there's basic stuff that he does that I'm charmed by again, just because it's been so long since I've really sat down and especially watched this era of his career. So, you know, the capo kick that he does in the corner, I just think looks like $1 million. He does a great crossbody to the floor at one point. I've said this before on this show. Wrestling is missing lovable baby faces doing crossbodies from the top rope to the floor. And I don't know why guys don't do that move anymore, but it looks really, really great when you do it well. And Liger does it very well in this match. Again, they sort of lose me with some of the Sasuke offense down the stretch, but then he goes and hits a Tiger Suplex and gets the win. And what I felt like was a 3.5-star match.
I was just at 4, just there with this. I thought it was good, but it like comparatively for like where things were in 1994, that if this match would have happened like right after the Sapporo matches, like the return, and maybe because we know that there was another Liger Sasuke match that was supposed to happen in 1994. If that happened at that time, I would feel like that this would have been the more kind of like the more natural kind of place for it. But Now we have three crowned Sasuke coming out of this match, but at least at this point with the British Commonwealth and the WWF Light Heavyweight title along with the IWP Junior.
That match goes 1927. We also get later on in the show at 1944, the great Muta defeating Jinsei Shinzaki in his return to Japan after a year in the WWF. I had never seen this match before. What's your history with this match?
This is the first time I've seen this match.
Okay. Yeah, I really loathe Muto as a wrestler. I don't like Muta. I don't like Muto. I tolerate some of the late 80s stuff. I tolerate some of the 2001 resurgence, but this is a guy who I've never ever connected to. And I found this to be, for his standards, which admittedly I find to be low, a very enjoyable performance from Muta and a stellar performance from Shinzaki.
Yeah, this is like I think this time of New Japan Dome shows is very kind of interesting, because later you would get like the Chono and Onita barbed wire match, but like this is very much kind of tonally of that kind of thing of like the wild outsider versus a big New Japan name and kind of a blood spectacle. And it's kind of heart of hearts. I have this note here, Case, and just because I have this written down, I want this, have this on audio. There's a part of me that felt like this match was very spiritually a QT Marshall, Big Boom AJ kind of match. Like, it was a lot of spectacle. It was a lot of punch and kick and bleeding. And the fact that like Shinzaki comes out, he puts up like this pilgrim post in the neutral corner, like designating this as one of his pilgrim stops here. And then the way that he bleeds when he gets stabbed with it is like one of like the coolest images by the end of this match, where his white pants are just completely soaked with his own blood. And it's just based off of this like stake attack. And I really thought that was really kind of cool to see that. And I think it was kind of like an inversion of Shinzaki in this position that we more often would like kind of see Sasuke in, I felt like. And that was interesting for me to see. I maybe have a little bit more of a Muto tolerance, that there is a charm to the guy that like, the video version of this, like, well, with like the VHS like effect and him coming into the Tokyo Dome with like his silver costume with like the pyro, and then like with all of this, he looks cool. And Shinsei Shinzaki looks very cool here, and it's a cool guys kind of match in the Tokyo Dome, and I like it for what it was for that.
Yeah, I think this match in many ways, and this is both a compliment and an insult, I think in many ways this match was ahead of its time. This really did have a spectacle feel that, you know, when you think about the other matches on this card, you know, the Hashimoto stuff, and especially like I love that Fujinami versus Tenryu match so much, but even Mox at his grittiest in 2026 doesn't do the things that made Tenryu versus Fujinami this special gritty match that it was. And Shinzaki versus Muta is very much the predecessor to, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but like an NXT TakeOver style of match, or like the best kind of WrestleMania style of match, which I think is really interesting, with the one caveat being that Shinzaki bleeds buckets, and my God, does he bleed buckets in this match. But it is, I mean, in the context of this show, I've never watched the show all the way through. I've just watched selected matches, but I mean, this has to stand out so much from anything else on the show, because it's so not 1996 New Japan. I mean, you're right. Even in this era of dome shows, with some of the spectacle matches they would do, it's just so different than any of the other ones, but it feels way closer to home in 2026 than I think it would have been 1996.
Yeah. It just was like an interesting kind of level of spectacle that kind of gets you with it, at least. And maybe like if this was more of a common thing that we would see from Muta in these kinds of situations, we'd be a little bit more welcoming of it, for lack of better words.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, this is one of those performances where I tolerate Muta and I leave really impressed with Shinzaki, which is just another one of those things that as we go throughout this project, I mean, I really didn't think much of this guy at all at the start of it. And now I'm realizing that at least through this point in time, he's a very interesting wrestler that I think has a very interesting ceiling in terms of what he can achieve. My guess is just knowing the cliff notes of his career, I think he might get really weird after this, and the way that we cover Shinzaki is going to get weird after this because, right, you know, he's going to work the Sumo Hall show in October, and he'll be around Michinoku Pro, and obviously any of the footage that makes tape, you know, from that we're going to talk about, but he becomes an FMW guy and he becomes an All Japan guy, and we'll dip our toes in, especially some of the All Japan stuff, we'll dip our toes in here and there. Maybe some of the FMW stuff, but Shinzaki just becomes, I think, a weirder wrestler with a weirder career. But we get this match, and I think this is, I don't know. I was looking through the observers, and there's not really any follow-ups here on just what the fallout of his performance was, because if I was New Japan, I think in 1996, after watching this, I would go, well, geez, I think I want this guy in my company full time. But he also sort of has, and this is a weird comparison to make, but he sort of has that CM Punk thing when Punk was working 01, where he was too big to be a junior, too small to be a heavyweight. And I think in 1996 New Japan, he's probably too big to be a junior, too small to be a heavyweight. And so that puts the kibosh on that.
And I think you still have, there are still the people within New Japan that would look down on and it as what they would see as like an indie guy coming in and being in that kind of position too.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that from what we saw that Jacob happening versus 1995 juniors division is a pretty big kind of thing of, well, maybe if Liger sticks around, maybe you can get him in with that. But I don't know Choshu if that's going to happen, bud.
Just a quick note from the Observer, this on 513, as Dave talked about the fallout from this show. He says, as of this past weekend, there were four different special magazines on the newsstand on the Dome show. Both Weekly Pro and Weekly Gong ran their usual special issues, plus Nikon Sports, a daily morning sports newspaper, and New Japan Magazine, the latter in its debut issue, were on the stands. Because of the banning of Weekly Pro by the office, they did a 50-page Observer-style issue with no photos at all on the show, which is mind-boggling that there'd be enough to write about on for one single show. The head of the baseball magazine Shaw Company, which publishes Weekly Pro, and Seiji Sakaguchi, the president of New Japan, are talking about mending fences because both groups are beginning to come across to the general public as heels, even though at the present time, both companies' business is excellent. Ricky Choshu is telling people that ending this ban is his decision, okay, and Sakaguchi has no power. What's up?
Of course, Choshu is saying that.
Yes, yeah. Ricky Choshu wants to make it clear that he is in charge. And then Dave continues saying, however, a lot of people expect a solution sometime over the next month. UWFI, WAR, Fujinami Promotions, and Katao Dojo have joined New Japan in banning the magazine, all through New Japan's influence. New Japan asked Michinoku Pro to join the band, but Michinoku Pro, caught between the proverbial rock and hard place, didn't say anything. Michinoku Pro made their company through lots of magazine coverage, and with the aforementioned companies out of the largest circulation weekly, it has only upped Michinoku's coverage. At the same time, they couldn't afford to turn down the New Japan offer because Sasuke was scheduled to win the IWP Junior title at the Dome, and they didn't want to insult New Japan and have them change their minds. I bring this up because I think it goes back to the importance of linking up with FMW at the start of Michinoku Pro's beginning, and specifically having Onita on Michinoku Pro branded shows in 1993. And you see a change in the magazine coverage once Onita shows up, and then they run Tokyo in 1994, and then they're in with the magazines because April of 1994, they run Sumo Hall for the first time, and then you're off to the races. And so now you have this spot where you not only have strong business with Michinoku Pro in 1996 to begin with, but now you have this Weekly Pro New Japan standoff that is only benefiting Michinoku Pro as they go throughout the calendar year.
Yeah, and the one thing that I feel like is worth kind of pointing out here, this has been like an ongoing issue, at least in the background of Japanese wrestling in 1995-1996. The overall kind of editorial kind of backlash between Pro and Gong and the booking offices. I mean, WAR was out on Weekly Pro well before this case because they were not on the Bridge of Dream shows that was put on by Weekly Pro, and Weekly Pro did not do anything about their Cork and Hall show that Weekly Gong was all over in response. So this is like a big kind of push and pull that was happening at this time. I know that there was issues with like Baba and Gong also happening. So like as much as there is like this push and pull between the promotions and just like this landscape that really over the last decade had just exploded, you also have like the thing of the two traditional powers kind of having the magazines they more like more so than the other, and the kind of the give and take of that as well.
We move on to a very interesting show in Michinoku Pro history. May 6th in Nakayama, we get two matches on this show, Shiryu and Minsteho versus Funaki and Taka Michinoku. Mike, your thoughts on this tag match before we talk about the other match on this show?
Oh, I love this tag match. Mm-hmm. Dream Chasers versus Teo and Shiryu. You knew I was going to love this match. I mean, the Dream Chasers have been like a delight of a team going on here. And you have everyone just trying to like provide two knee bars to each other throughout it. And like the fact that these two are kind of the necessary foils and the men in the middle of the Kaintai Deluxe and Dolphin Corps kind of feud. And then the fact that at the end of this match, both Kai and Tai members are trying to court Dream Chasers coming out of it after a match that is, at least at this point, with the give and take and us talking about the big stylistic change that's starting to happen in this promotion, this feels like a really high-level junior heavyweight tag match that wouldn't feel kind of out of place in the 2000s or 2010s.
It's a very strange match just in terms of the structure and the momentum of it, because there's just a lot of back and forth in the sense that I don't really feel like there are prolonged periods of heat for either team. I do think this match eventually does find this way, though, in the interesting way that it's set up. I love, and I have this in my notes, I love when this turns into a, quote, beat the shit out of Funaki fest, and then very shortly after that, Taka is about to go for a spaceman dive, and as he's running towards the ropes, Teo cuts him off with a lariat, and I just think the way that Teo did that looks so good. This, you know what?
His short-distance lariats are insane, because it's the same thing that happened in the Otaku match, too. His short-arm lariats are insane.
It shows, I think, specifically with Taka, and I guess Funaki, because he's working in battle arts, too, but just that other side of Michinoku that, you know, as we go along and, you know, we talk about, you know, Hoshikawa and Nakajima and what their role in this company is and how they differ from some of the Hamada trainees, but just how ingrained some battle arts stuff is to this promotion that I don't really think people realize. I mean, you might see these names on paper and think of it as one sort of match, but it is a mat based shit kicker match, far more than it is, you know, the 316 trios match that we covered at the start of this episode.
Yeah, no, this is a match that afterwards you're wondering how no one walked out of it with black eyes with it. And this is turning into like a backdrop promotion too at the same time, and like short angle backdrops that are just dumping people on their necks at this point.
Yes, no, very much so. So after the match, Shiryu and Teho, they go to shake Taka and Funaki's hands, and Taka and Funaki blow them off. So they're still not in the heel unit yet. That then leads us to the main event of this show, British Junior Heavyweight title match, Dick Togo versus Danny Collins, because Collins had won this belt back on some show. I don't have it in my notes. I can't find it. Doesn't matter, because it's the British Junior Heavyweight title and it doesn't matter. Oh, no, I've got it here. This was on 5-5 in Miyagi. This is the match I was talking about earlier where Danny Collins submitted Sasuke in 2 minutes, and then we get to this match the next day, Togo versus Danny Collins. Here's my point on this match, Mike. I gave it a rating of 3.25 stars. I thought it was super fun. I thought it was super fun. I really enjoyed it. I'm just guessing, and I say that I want to preface this. I say this with all the love in the world. I am just guessing that somehow in all of the wrestling that he's watched over the years, that Phil Schneider has just missed this match, because I could see a certain type of wrestling fan thinking this is the greatest match of all time, because this is the predecessor for the Dick Togo revival in the late 2000s and early 2010s. This is the blueprint for the Antonio Honda DDT match that everybody loves, myself included. I think it's a five-star match. During the peak of Michinoku Pro, the height of Lucha Wrestling, we get this weird Memphis-inspired Dick Togo versus Danny Collins match, and I just can't believe that more people don't talk about this when they talk about the legacy of Dick Togo.
Yeah, I mean, like, within, like, the first few minutes, he's going to him on the outside with a fork.
Togo is stabbing this man in the head.
And, like, it really does a great job of getting, like, this crowd behind Danny Collins. Like, Danny Collins is treated like the big baby face throughout the match, and it's and I feel like you got to see a lot more of him than what you really see in that Sasuke clipped match here. And it's
I like him in this match. I found him to be a really compelling wrestler in this match.
Yeah, and I think that, like, you had Togo, who is just deciding to maul him throughout it, and that at this point, like, very quickly, like, the Michinoku Pro crowds now have gotten kind of conditioned towards, like, Kaientai Deluxe like this, because they're really, really vehemently behind the baby faces at this point. And even though, like Sato, I'm sorry, the second time this episode, we should have a name change jar for me. Even though Togo wins the match with a top rope senton, and it's a really, like, kind of, like, proficient match, it is a kind of weird match in a way, just because of, like, it's just, you're right, like, this is a Segunda Keita ass match.
It really, I mean, I don't know Phil super well, but I'm going to DM him after we're done here and say, hey, have you seen this match? I feel like your ilk would really champion this in 1996 Michinoku Pro. This would be the takeaway of, like, hey, you know what match is really good from this time period is Dick Togo versus Danny Collins from May 6th, which I feel like we get in full. I mean, if it's clipped, it's not clipped by much, because we get a lot of this match, and it's just awesome. I mean, in the span of, let's just say, 3 months, you know, you get Togo and Teo versus Pantera and Hamada, which we talk about at the beginning of this episode. You get a match like Togo versus Collins, and then we'll talk about in the next episode Togo versus Jushin Thunder Liger. And to just have three great matches like that in the span of 3 months that are all so different. I mean, just completely different styles of wrestling in each of those. I was just about to say, I don't know if I need to do the hard sell on how great Dick Togo is, but if you're somebody that has maybe started watching Japanese wrestling, you know, in a pandemic or a post-pandemic universe, you know, it's hard to comprehend now, because he is the single worst thing about New Japan Pro Wrestling in a promotion that features a lot of things that I actively don't like. He is probably the worst thing in that promotion, but this is an all-time great, all-time versatile, brilliant mind. And you really get to see it in matches like this, because for as great as Taka is at doing his own thing, and you have the charm of Sasuke, and, you know, you've got Hamada full time now, I don't think anybody else on this roster is capable of having that style of match. And just to run across it once in a comp tape is a rather refreshing thing. He also, just to put a bow on this, hits maybe the most insane top rope senton that he's ever hit to finish off this match.
Yeah, no, like, he is getting beefy at this point, and he knows how to put that weight to his advantage.
Collins is in the middle of the ring. And so, you know, that, yeah. I mean, he's jumping from the top and kicking his feet out and then landing on his back. Collins is in the middle of the ring, and Togo crushes him.
And, like, the wild thing is, like, on this comp tape, like, Tiger Mask 4 has a top rope headbutt that is 4/5 of the ring too. Like, this is, like, a great, if you want to like see, like, the best version of certain kinds of moves, I think you see the best versions of both the top rope headbutt and the top rope senton within, like, a 1 hour period on this tape.
I think that's right. So that is 5/6. We then jump ahead another month. We go to June now, and Mike, I'm gonna lump these three matches together. 6/8, 6/14, and 6/15. And then if you have thoughts on them, please share. So on June 8th, we get Delphin, Funaki, and Taka versus Togo, Teho, and Shiryu. This is heavily clipped, which is a bummer. I would really like to see this match in full because of these three matches, this is far and away the most entertaining one. This starts with the heels trying to shake the hands of Taka and Funaki. Delphin then sort of breaks it up and charges at the heels before Taka and Funaki can do anything. And then the heels beat the shit out of Delphin, which is fantastic. We get Delphin getting his mask ripped. We get to see the Kai and Tai Deluxe Pyramid spot with Togo on top flexing, which might be the first time that we've seen that. Certainly the first time we've seen that as Kai and Tai Deluxe and not just Kai and Tai. We get another insane Dick Togo senton. Taka and Funaki bail on Delphin. And then we get a post-match angle, which Delphin is getting his ass kicked, and Sasuke once again makes the save. We jump ahead to June 14th. This is Nanawa, Funaki, and Taka versus Togo, Teho, and Shiryu. Taka and Funaki ignore the handshake from the heels at the start of this match and then attack them. We then get a very clipped and I thought average match between these six guys. And then at the end of the match, everyone shakes hands but Nanawa, and they leave Nanawa out of the handshake. And so I missed something, but this feels mm-hmm. like a rather anticlimactic way for Taka and Funaki to join this heel unit after all of this time spent trying to court them and get them involved. And then the next day on 6:15, we get Nanawa and Delphin versus Teo and Shiryu. And this is an odd match in that it ends after Shiryu. There's a ref bump. Shiryu hits Delphin with a chair, and then Shiryu grabs Delphin and has him pin Nanawa, even though they're partners mm-hmm. and the ref counts three, and that's the end of the match. So 6:08 is fantastic. 6:14 is a good match, and then I think a disappointing angle, and then 6:15 I thought was just odd.
Yeah, and that handshake, it's like so understated that they just kind of walk away and they don't really appear on the 6:15 match. And it's kind of worth noting that, like, they had, at least as of the end of the tape, we don't have a 10-man team match with the entire 5-man complement. We don't have Taka and Funaki like teaming with Manseo. Like it's not like full integration at this point, but we do get, like, in the last Michi Pro news section, a part where Dream Chaser is quitting on Delphin, like, during, like, the clips of, like, the various matches. They, like, after one of the matches, like, Taka's, like, cutting a promo and is quitting Delphin Core. So you have that happen later on, but it's not necessarily, like, the thing that I wonder, like, how necessarily, like, if you are a Michinoku fan, basically, keeping up in this promotion in real time, I guess it would be, like, seeing what happens in the weekly kind of magazines, and maybe it is a thing where it goes to print, and you have 6:14 happen, and then this promo happens on 6:16, and it's in the next issue, and that's kind of how you kind of keep up on it. Because I do kind of wonder, like, if as a active fan, how do you kind of keep up with that sort of thing? And you don't necessarily have it. And you also have the fact that they are still teaming with Nanawa as of the end of this tape, even though, like, the big angle that we'll talk about ending Fukushima happens with them on the Kai and Tai Deluxe side, they're still teaming with Nanawa, but by the end of this month still. So they're not fully in Kai Tai Deluxe, it feels like.
Yeah, it's always been weird the way Michinoku does that sometimes, where they're just slow to do those full shifts. I felt that way, you know, when Kai and Tai formed also. Sometimes I find their booking and their alignments to be needlessly confusing.
Yeah, just to correct myself. So Fukushima is the last thing we have things on, and they team with Nanawa on that show. They team with Teo and Togo the previous night in Naruko. It's not against anyone in Delphin Core, but they are teaming with them in that sense. And that is the show where they quit Delphin Core after Mascara Magica wins the NWA Welter or the CMLL Welter title.
Right on. And so we end on June 23rd. We get the Michinoku Pro Mega Powers. It is Sasuke and Delphin in a handicap match. against Togo, Teho, and Shiryu, the main characters of this comp tape. It seems like those guys have been in all the great things. And we end with, I think, one of the more infamous matches in Michidoku Pro history.
Yeah, this is just an absolute destruction and a lesson why you should never agree to be in a handicap match. Because like the tone of the match is, it's never enough because they don't have a third person, because you have like moments where they go for like a double pen and then Dick Togo's there just to kick the shit out of them for attempting those sorts of things. And at the end, it's just not, it's never enough. You have like a wild brawl that pulls Sasuke to one side of Fukushima while they just go in on Delphin like sharks in the water at it, on his mask, and just like an incredible like 3-on-1 beatdown. And it's just, at least for me, like as much as we saw in March the new thesis for the Lucha Rest trios match, we're having an evolution already 3 months later with now like a really fully fledged heel unit acting heel unit throughout a match and a mask grip kind of scenario.
You know, because to summarize the journey of Kaientai Deluxe, again, you go back to the last thing we talked about in the last episode, March 15th, Shiryu leaves with Togo in Osaka, very clearly on the opposite side of Sasuke and Tiger Mask. The next night in Tokyo, there's that backstage promo we talked about where Shiryu once again ignores Sasuke's pleading, very clearly sides with Dick Togo. So he's a lost cause at this point. On March 23rd, you get that big angle where the heels attack Funaki and Taka and Yone Genjin while they're also beating down Delphin. That's when Sasuke makes the save. The crowd goes nuts. We get Sasuke and Delphin shaking hands and aligning for the first time in Michidoku Pro history. You get the angle in May where Shiryu and Teo go for a handshake and Taka and Funaki blow them off. On June 8th, you get another Delphin post-match angle where once again Sasuke makes the save, and I think that's probably the best post-match angle of this build. You get the June 14th angle where everybody shakes hands but Nanawa, and so you get Taka and Funaki a little bit more aligned with Kaientai Deluxe, and then you get this match on 6/23 where it's almost more effective than it is good, but it's just the perfect handicap match. It's worked in the most logical way that is really engaging, but really satisfying. You're never bored, despite, to use a gross American wrestling term, the numbers game always being too much for Sasuke and Delphin. They work it in the way that you should. If this was a 3-on-2 fight in real life, I think it would mirror this. And then what I think is great is as Sasuke is beaten down on the floor and nowhere to be found, the match ends with all three of the Kaientai guys pinning Delphin in sort of a triple stack pin. And I just thought that was a perfect way to encapsulate this match.
Yeah, that was after a triple powerbomb and three consecutive splashes ending with the top rope senton. And at that moment, just exerting pure domination over the United Forces. We go into the post-match segment where the beatdown continues. Nanawa and the rest of the roster and Nanawa come out to save Delphin. And it's a huge pop when Nanawa is out there. And it's a whole pull apart of Sekigun trying to fight down Kaientai Deluxe. They kind of finally get them all to the floor, but Nanawa storming off, pissed off. He is not fully on board with this whole business of teaming with Great Sasuke, and he's not super happy with Delphin, but we do have a United 5 in Kaientai Deluxe, and the rest of Michinoku Pro by this point in 1996 is left wondering how can they prevent this force from growing and completely destroying the promotion.
It's a really, really enjoyable series of matches we get on this comp tape. I mean, if you just throw out the New Japan stuff here, I think you're looking at a great 2.5 hours of wrestling that tells a great story, that has great matches, and that leaves you really wanting more, because you leave with the mystery of who in the hell is going to stop Kaientai Deluxe. And then you factor in less so Sasuke Liger, but more so Shinzaki Muto. And I found this watch list for this Michidoku Pro Those Days episode to be highly, highly enjoyable.
Yeah, this just absolutely rocked. And it is, I just love like the idea of like this one comp tape that goes essentially for 3 months of the year. And what it does is you get kind of like this full taste of where the promotion's at as like the big formative thing that the promotion will be known for is happening just kind of live, mostly in front of you. And that's a really kind of fun thing. I mean, the only downside of this versus the kind of Champ Forum format is we miss out on the debuts of Kness and Gamma, and also seeing people like Kendo and Hamada a whole lot more. But the promotion's in a real fun and interesting place, and especially as they end this comp tape, we're really left with that question of who can stop Kaientai Deluxe.
As we look ahead to episode 15 of Those Days in Michinoku Pro Retrospective, I know on the next episode we are going to be talking about Sasuke versus Liger at the Inoki Peace Festival and some of the oddities around that show. We're also going to go back to New Japan for Skydiving J and all of the Michinoku Pro guys that were featured on that show, including the iconic Togo versus Liger match. We're going to go to Mexico and spend some time with the great Sasuke. And then after that, I don't know what we're going to cover, but the plan is to cover the World Championship title series, the formation of the J Crown, and also Jushin Thunder Liger's debut, long-awaited, much-anticipated debut in Michinoku Pro. Hopefully we can get through all of that next time. That might end up being a two-parter, but that is the plan for the next time that we talk to you on Those Days.
Yep, and I can't wait for us to get to that. You can follow Those Days on social media at Open Voice Gate, both on Twitter and on Blue Sky. Case is at _ in your case on Twitter. I'm at Fujiheya. Also, there's the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That's where we have the Open the Voice Gate channel, where we post all of our match listings and notes for these shows. We are getting together a landing site that will be at voicesofwrestling.com too. That will be a kind of a one-stop place for trying to for the shows, the match listings, and everything like that. But for now, the best place to kind of keep up with that is in the Voices of Wrestling Discord and the Open the Voice Gate channel. But that's going to do it for this time for us on Those Days. We'll be back with you next time with High Flying Jay and the Inoki Peace Festival. Take care, everyone.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.